Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the only journalist to interview Edward Snowden since he surfaced in Hong Kong, Peter Maas, a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine, where he recently wrote an 8,000-word profile of Laura Poitras, how Laura Poitras helped Snowden spill his secrets. We will discuss how Peter Maas was able to get the interview and what he knows about who has custody of the thousands of top secrets Edward Snowden left the country with, a small portion of which have been made public. Then we'll examine the role of the reactionary Mubarak-era media in Egypt and the extent to which it is driving the polarization as Egypt descends into violence. Noha Radwan, a professor of Arabic and comparative literature at the University of California, Davis, joins us to discuss how both the government and the independent TV channels have inflamed the deep divisions with frenzied descriptions of the Muslim Brotherhood as terrorists by the pro-military media, while the pro-Islamist media portrays the current regime as fascists. Then finally, we'll get a flavor of the Association for Unmanned Vehicles Systems International's trade show underway at the vast Washington Convention Center, where the 600 vendors are showing off the latest in drone technology, surveillance equipment, and high-tech sensors for both military and civilian use. Alexei Kosov, a multimedia journalist currently working for the Los Angeles Times' Washington Bureau, joins us to discuss his article in the Los Angeles Times with Brian Bennett, Drones Descend on Washington Just for Show, and the FAA's opening up of the nation's airspace in 2015 to an estimated 10,000 unmanned aircraft by 2020. And joining us is Peter Maas, who's a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine, who has reported from the Middle East, Asia, South America, and Africa. He has also written for The New Yorker, The Atlantic Monthly, The Washington Post, and Slate. And Peter Maas is the author of Love Thy Neighbor, A Story of War, which chronicled the Bosnian War and won prizes from the Overseas Press Club and the Los Angeles Times. His latest book is Crude World, The Violent Twilight of Oil. And he profiled Laura Poitras, who photographed the only footage and interviews available of Edward Snowden in Hong Kong, and Laura Poitras served as an intermediary with Edward Snowden, enabling Peter Maas to do the only interview with him since he spoke on camera in Hong Kong. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Maas.
Good to be with you.
And you described in your New York Times Magazine piece profiling Laura Poitras how the whole Edward Snowden's statements, his leaks, if you will, were generated, and how, I guess, in a way, he sought Laura out first, didn't he?
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, he sought Glenn Greenwald, the Guardian columnist, first, but Glenn wasn't able to kind of open his encrypted channel of communication with Snowden, so Snowden then went to Laura Poitras. And because she had been working on a film about surveillance, because she had been under surveillance herself, she was living somewhat of an encrypted life and was very savvy with these things and was able to offer him a public encryption key and so they could begin to have encrypted, secure communications. And that's where things really got going.
And Laura, of course, had made this very, very, I thought, very, very poignant film about Iraq, where she talked to Iraqis about what was actually happening to their country. And apparently that put her on the no-watch, no-fly list, did it not? She was regularly searched every time she got on a plane.
Well, we don't know for sure what got her on the list. This is one of the strange things about these watch lists, no-fly lists, extra screening lists, is that the government doesn't tell people who are on these lists, first off, whether they're on them, and then once people become aware because they're getting stopped, the government doesn't tell them why they're on it. So you can't kind of, you know, there's been an accusation made against you or whatever. You don't know what it is, so you can't perhaps get yourself off the list because you don't belong there. And in the case of Laura, she's filed Freedom of Information requests, and she has tried to find out why she's on the list. She's asked every time that she's been stopped, why is this happening? And she's never told. So she doesn't know why she's on the list. What we do know is that these stops at airports began in the summer of 2006. And what I also found out is that there were investigators from the Department of Homeland Security's Joint Terrorism Task Force that interviewed soldiers who were in Baghdad at the time that Laura Poitras was there, who believed that she was filming an attack against them and had foreknowledge of it. This allegation which was investigated by the Department of Homeland Security. I don't know if this is the cause for her getting on the watch list. I looked into it. It has really, there's no evidence to it whatsoever. It just makes no sense whatsoever. But it is something that was looked into by the government. And whether this is the reason or one of the reasons that she got on the watch list, we don't know.
And Peter Musk, obviously Edward Snowden has become the story. It's really the message which he wants to get out to the world about what the U.S. government is doing in terms of surveilling American citizens. And even, of course, in response to what happened, the President of the United States called for a public debate, a national debate. That hasn't happened yet, although there was a very close vote in the House indicating a swing, I think, in public opinion. And then the Pew Research Center did do a poll indicating that just within a year, the American people have swung where they previously were in favor of more surveillance in the war on terror to a belief that the government has gone too far. So I think it's fair to say that the focus has been on the messenger and not on the message. But what's your understanding of why he chose to go essentially to end up in two countries that are ultimately sort of hostile, if not unfriendly, to the United States, China and Russia?
I did not talk to him about that, so I don't have any particular inside information about that. All that I can just observe about it is that there are very few countries that he or anyone in his position could go to with any degree of confidence that they would not be immediately extradited to the United States. So he had, I think, first off, limited choices of where to go. If he went to a nice democratic country like France or Germany or whatever, they would probably hand him over quite quickly to the United States. And then secondly, he did receive offers of asylum from several countries in South America, and he was apparently on his way there, but he got stopped in Moscow because he didn't have the full travel papers that he needed for onward travel. His passport had been revoked by the time he got there. And so actually, it depends on how one, wants to interpret it, but, my understanding of what happened is not so much that he chose to go to Russia for asylum, but that he got trapped in Russia. And then once there, he asked for asylum because there was nowhere else to go. The United States had forced down the aircraft carrying the Bolivian president when he was flying out of Moscow because they thought Snowden was on it. So this meant that Snowden, whatever flight he might take out of Moscow to go to one of the countries that offered him asylum, there was a reasonable chance that that flight would be forced down so that he could be extradited to the United States. So I think, therefore, the framing of it as, Snowden chose to go to Russia or chose to seek asylum there is really not correct. The correct way of understanding it is that Snowden got trapped in Russia, and so that's where he had no other choice but to ask for asylum because he couldn't get out.
And again, I'm speaking with Peter Musk, who's a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine, who has reported from the Middle East, Asia, South America, and Africa. He also is the author of Love Thy Neighbor, A Story of War, which chronicled the Bosnian War and won prizes from the Overseas Press Club and the Los Angeles Times. And his latest book is Crude World, The Violent Twilight of Oil. And he recently did a profile of Laura Poitras for the New York Times Magazine. And Laura Poitras served as an intermediary with Edward Snowden, who Peter Musk was able to interview recently in the only, post-Hong Kong interview that he's done. And so tell me about how that was set up. It was an encrypted interview, was it not?
Yeah, well, basically, without kind of getting too much into some of the details, but basically I was working on the story and Laura asked me, this is over. We weren't together at that time. I went to Rio to talk with her and Glenn Greenwald, but this is after. I wasn't in Rio at the time. We were not in the same place. And so we were communicating through an encrypted channel, and she said, would you like to ask some questions to Snowden? She had not asked him whether he would answer them, but she just said, I'm willing to submit to give him your questions. And I said, sure. So I sent her, again, through encrypted means, questions for Snowden, and she then transmitted them to him through, probably much more highly encrypted means. And he decided to answer them, and he sent them back to her encrypted, and then they were sent back to me by Laura encrypted, and then had to hold on to it for a little while, and then finally we were able to publish the answers, and that's how they got to the public.
And they got to the public via the New York Times, who published the transcript of your interview with Edward J. Snowden. And his comments, Edward Snowden's comments, are not favorable to the New York Times, or for that matter, for what is often referred to as the mainstream media.
That's correct. The first question I asked him was, you know, why did you choose Laura Poitras and Glenn Greenwald as opposed to a reporter for the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal? And he immediately responded saying, you know, basically the mainstream media had discredited itself in the last decade by not challenging the United States government and had, not provided the information that it should have provided to American citizens, and that it was only reporters like Laura and Glenn who had, in his words, the courage to report, you know, fearlessly on surveillance and other matters that the U.S. government perhaps didn't want to be either reported on or reported on in the way that they did. And so that's why he chose to go to them. And that was the first question I asked, and that was his blunt answer. And, the answers, we published the transcript on the New York Times site, also published it on my website. These were questions that were submitted to him by me. I'm an independent writer. I was writing this story for the New York Times. But the New York Times has done a very good job of publishing this full transcript, as well as a story I wrote that's nearly 8,000 words long that goes into great detail on what happened.
So how did you, did you have a limited amount of questions you could ask? Did you have to do some triage yourself? Or, in other words, were there any ground rules to the interview?
No, there were no ground rules. You've got to understand that the offer was made by Laura to simply transmit my questions to Snowden. She didn't know whether he would answer them. He hadn't, as far as I know, asked her to get questions from me. So when I, drew up the list of questions, first off, there are no ground rules, but I was working on a story that was focused on Laura Poitras and Glenn Greenwald and how kind of they got this whole story. So I decided to just limit my questions to that issue, Snowden's interactions with Greenwald and Poitras, his reasons for going to them, and his reaction to them once he finally met them. So I just decided to limit it to that, to make it kind of simpler and easier. And I kept the number of questions relatively short, just about six questions or so, because with kind of sub-questions embedded in each, because I felt that if I asked a whole laundry list of questions, he might just kind of think, as anybody in that situation would, oh, my God, I don't have time for all this. So I kept it short and sweet.
But clearly, there are a lot of questions to ask, right?
There are a lot of questions to ask, and I was... pleasantly surprised that he decided to answer them, and B, he answered them very directly. It's easy particularly when you're given written questions and there's no follow-up, to avoid answering them or just to answer them in a way that, isn't necessarily very direct. But he took each question and he answered them very directly, very concisely. It was really useful.
And what do we know, or do you know, Peter Maas, about what exactly everybody has in this saga? Because there's been a lot of speculation that the Chinese intelligence got the four laptops, which I'm not sure exactly what the source for the fact that he supposedly had four laptops and a bunch of thumb drives, but that's been the assumption that's been in the press since the story began, and that the Russians also had access to it. Barton Gellman of the Washington Post was there in Hong Kong. It doesn't seem like the Washington Post has published too much. The UK Guardian seems to have taken the lead in publishing what they have so far. One of the things we heard from Glenn Greenwald was that there is an ability to drop a huge cache of information into the public, so presumably it exists. And I imagine it's driving the intelligence people crazy to know that all this stuff's out there, and I imagine they've done their own damage control to find out what they think has been taken. But what's your understanding of who has what, and also why the Post hasn't published anything, the UK Guardian has?
Well, let's see, one at a time here. The Washington Post story, they had a couple of stories based on documents from Snowden, but the writer who wrote those for the Washington Post, who you mentioned, Barton Gellman, did not go to Hong Kong.
No, I see.
Was not in Hong Kong. Was not part of that very crucial part. So I don't know how many documents he or the Washington Post might have, but as of now, they have just published a couple of stories based on what appears to be a very small number of documents. I know nothing more than that. In terms of what Snowden has, and I do not know myself, in terms of whether other entities, Chinese government, whatever, might have gotten a hold of whatever he had or has, I have absolutely no idea. So I can't speak to that. There is no sourcing that I'm aware of for the stories that mention that the Chinese got whatever was on his laptops. It seems to anybody who has said that or has said that the Russians have gotten material from him, not necessarily voluntarily, but hacked into his computers. There's no sourcing I've seen for that in the sense of, like, you know, they got this information from somebody in the Russian intelligence service or Chinese intelligence services. It seems to just be rank speculation. What I do know, and what has been stated publicly, is that Greenwald and Poitras are in possession of thousands of documents that was given to them, were given to them by Snowden. The exact number, I don't know. Different numbers have been floated out there, but it is thousands, of which they've only published so far a handful. And they told me that they have not shared these documents with any of the publications, the entire collection of documents with any of the publications that they have published with. They have published with The Guardian, mainly, but also Der Spiegel in Germany and Globo in Brazil, and I believe they are planning to publish with other publications as well. But they provide to those publications only the documents that are relevant to the stories they are publishing with those publications. The kind of, full files are under their control and have not been handed over, they told me, to any of the publications that they publish with.
And does that include WikiLeaks? They seem to have played a fairly important role, at least in terms of getting him the papers to get out of Hong Kong. And
It's not known. They certainly appear to have played a role, because somebody who was a volunteer for WikiLeaks was with Snowden, and Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks or co-founder of WikiLeaks, has tweeted about communicating and being involved in Snowden's journey from Hong Kong to Russia and his asylum application. But as far as WikiLeaks having documents, Snowden providing WikiLeaks with documents, or Greenwald and Poitras providing documents to WikiLeaks, I do not know of any of that, and I really can't say any more than that.
So I take it that Laura Poitras has the scoop of a lifetime in her film, that she's been making a film about the surveillance state, and this whole surveillance summer has been preoccupied with Edward Snowden, and all we've seen so far is what Laura has filmed. So do you have any sense of when this film will be completed? Not that Act 3 is over yet?
I really can't say. I mean, I do not know for sure. I don't know if Laura knows for sure. She is still working on it. And as you know, when you're working on a film or when you're working on a book, you never know really when you're going to get it all finished. And certainly the fact that the Snowden thing has just happened and it's still ongoing and represents, as you mentioned, the story of a lifetime, but also just more practically a huge amount of material to integrate into a film that was already well along. I don't know when this film is going to come out. She's working, all out on both continuing to publish some of these documents as well as working on her film.
And is she going to go with Bruce Fein and Lon Snowden, Edward's father, who are heading to Russia soon?
I really can't say.
Right. Well, I've spoken to Bruce about it, and I don't know whether you know Bruce Fein, but he's a very passionate defender of the Fourth Amendment, and he is, obviously a somebody that had an enormous amount of government experience, but is really an extraordinary voice in his concerns for how much the surveillance state has overtaken our constitutional rights. I just also spoke with Bill Arkin a couple of days ago, whose new book, American Coup, is a devastating expose of the extent to which our rights have dissipated and how we have a kind of alternative universe of the Constitution that we think we know about, the one that they teach us in school, and you hold your hand over your heart and salute the flag over, and then there's this other part that he calls the XYZ of the Constitution, arguing that a bunch of gray men, desk-bound men, agents of the national security state, are operating in an alternative universe that is almost unstoppable, because in the information age, there is no such thing as enough information. So, the enormous investments in the national security state and in this pursuit for more and more and better and better algorithms, according to Bill Arkin, is all but unstoppable. Did any of this dichotomy come up, if you will, even though it's essentially at the heart of the story of what Laura and Edward Snowden have done?
Well, I think it's, the question of whether it's unstoppable or not is what they're working on. That's, I think step one for Snowden, and this is just me kind of reading the tea leaves, is making it known what is being collected. And step two, which is not in his hands, is people reacting to it, and if they think it's too much in the way of data collection and surveillance, working through Congress or other means to make sure that this much data is not collected, that it's protected, that it remains private. So, it would certainly be unstoppable if nobody was aware of it and paying attention to it. But now that people are a bit more aware of it, it becomes, the potential for stopping it is greater, which doesn't mean it's likely, but the potential for at least slowing down the accumulating speed of it, and also for just making people aware of what is going on, that certainly is greater.
Well, Peter Maas, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Peter Maas, who's a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine, who has reported from the Middle East, Asia, South America, and Africa. He's also written for The New Yorker, The Atlantic Monthly, The Washington Post, and Slate. And Peter Maas is the author of Love Thy Neighbor, A Story of War, which chronicled the Bosnian War and won prizes from the Overseas Press Club and the Los Angeles Times. His latest book is Crude World, The Violent Twilight of Oil. And he just published a 8,000-word piece in the New York Times Magazine, How Laura Poitras Helped Snowden Spill His Secrets. And Laura Poitras served as an intermediary with Edward J. Snowden, who Peter Maas was able to interview. And that interview was published also recently in the New York Times. Thanks again, Peter.
Thank you.
We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the role of the reactionary media in Egypt stirring up the polarized and dangerous politics of that divided country. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Noah Aradwan, who is a professor of Arabic and Comparative Literature at the University of California, Davis. She was born in Egypt and was among the participants in the Tahrir protests of 2011. Welcome to Background Briefing, Noah Aradwan.
Thank you.
And you have written about how polarized the media is in Egypt, and it is certainly that is certainly the case. You have state-run media and some private televisions that are both fiercely anti-Morsi, and then you have the Muslim Brotherhood-affiliated stations such as RR25 and Al-Sharia. who are supporting and showing around the clock filming of the protesters being evicted, while on the state TV channels such as Channel One and Nile News, as well as the private on TV and CBC, are more or less carrying similar footage, but from the point of view of the army and the police. And I take it that this is in many ways what's exacerbating the polarization of this country. And is there any way to moderate it or this frenzy on both sides?
No, I think we need a new channel that has different ethics when reporting.
So what would that be? Is that we're just talking about theoretical?
No, I mean, you're asking a very hypothetical question. What is the solution to this problem that Egypt faces? And there's only one solution that I can see, not that I see any of it emerging already, but actually the country is in dire need of a new ethics of reporting and new ethics of media transparency, which we have been lacking for a long time now.
Well, prior to this, there was that whole incident that took place as a result of an obscure film that was made here in Southern California by a Coptic Christian activist, which is a polite way of describing him. And it managed to be shown on Egyptian television, which I believe one of the channels is owned by the richest man in Egypt. And that, of course, created this whole eruption that took place on the anniversary of 9/11 that led to the killing of the American diplomats in Benghazi.
Actually, I'm not aware that this film was aired. I think we're talking about a few seconds by way of denouncing it. That movie was not aired in Egypt.
It wasn't aired. But
no.
I thought that that there was a connection with the richest man in Egypt owning this.
I don't know what you mean by the richest man in Egypt. I think you're talking about Naguib Sawiris, who owns this TV channel called On TV.
On TV, right.
He's Christian himself.
Mm-hmm.
So, the whole movie.
I see. Well, it's just that now Aram Online, which is a website of Egypt's official newspaper, are reporting that 30 churches across the country have been completely devastated in reprisal attacks by furious Islamists. So you do have manifestations already of violence in this heading in this dangerous and polarizing direction, and angry Islamists have also attacked at least a dozen police stations around the country, according to state news media, killing more than 40 police officers.
Yes, it's true. But, I mean, to report is one thing. To report accurately and fairly is a different story. There are lots of stories on both sides of the divide. There are channels who are reporting on the atrocities of the police and others who are reporting on the violence by the Muslim Brothers. But I haven't yet found a channel that reports fairly on both sides and the violence and atrocities committed by both sides.
And in terms of the media from outside of Egypt, like Al Jazeera, they've already been met with an enormous amount of hostility. The Al Jazeera reporters were kicked out of press conferences when the military and Tamerlan first announced this deposing of Morsi. And so they're deeply unpopular with
they used to be trustworthy and very credible until the revolution. Shortly after the revolution, they started to show bias towards the Muslim Brothers, and so they have become unpopular and unwelcome. Not that this is an excuse for kicking them out of a press conference, but this is a reason why Egyptians don't take them as a credible source of information. What happens in the country right now is people watch a bit of CBC and on TV and a bit of Al Jazeera and try to come up with the story as they think is most plausible, not that they have a good source of information that they can trust.
So so I was talking yesterday with Jawad Nabulsi, who's one of the participants in the original revolution. He started the first aid stations for those wounded, and he himself was shot and is blind in one eye. And he was actually gave a very, very depressing portrait of where the secular and liberal people stand now. He felt completely isolated, completely marginalized, that you have a country polarized between the Muslim Brotherhood supporters and the army and the police from the early era, and then you've got what he described as the couch party,
I have to concur with Khaled Nabulsi on that one. The liberals in Egypt and those who actually cared about the aspirations of the 2011 revolution found them a difficult position. Some of them decided that it is okay to ally yourself with the military in order to get rid of the Brotherhood, thinking that this is the lesser evil. Others rejected the alliance with the military, thinking that this is actually going to repeat the little jingle that we used to sing for kids, you know, the woman who swallowed the fly and men swallowed the horse to eat the fly. You don't play with the military because they are the strongest institution in the country, not only, you know, as far as the military goes, but politically and economically as well. So the liberals got divided between these two camps. And currently, the country is very polarized between those who support the military intervention, even momentarily, and those who are opposed to it. And people who are opposed to it find themselves really marginalized. Their voice is really not welcome in many channels.
So given that you have Noha Radwan, again, professor of Arabic and comparative literature at the University of California, Davis, she was born in Egypt and was among the participants in the Tahrir protests of 2011. And given that you have Martian law being declared for a month now, and we don't know what's going to happen on Friday with Friday prayers, whether there's going to be more bloodletting. One of the things that Jawad Namusi told me yesterday, I think it was, I spoke with him, was that he had been going to the Muslim Brotherhood encampments and noticed that they were getting more and more dispirited as they were sitting around, and he noticed that he ran into a bunch of supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood at the beach over the weekend who'd finally given up, and he just felt that it was that the military were you know boneheaded in doing what they did, because eventually the protest was going to dissipate on its own, and now they've just turned these people into martyrs. Is that your sense of what's happened?
I don't have the same sense that he has, since I'm not in Cairo. I haven't been there for 2 weeks, and I can't tell on the spirit in the encampments. I would like for them to come up with an alternate strategy other than demonstrating on the street, because that is going to turn violent, I imagine. You know, they have squandered so many opportunities for a political resolution to the conflict that we find at a dead end right now. They have squandered it before June 30th and right after June 30th and since the mandate to the military on the 26th of July. I would be surprised if they opt for it now, and unfortunately it's too late. There's too much loss of life on their part. I mean, at this point, they really have gotten themselves into a position where they have very little to lose. I can't imagine what's going to happen on Friday.
But it does. Do you have any sense, and I know you're not there, and it's difficult to gauge these things, do you have any sense of the weight of the support for the military and for, you know, what is happening now? Because a lot of the reports you get indicate that certainly with the Tamarod movement that brought about the original coup that they didn't want to call a coup, and now we have an overt and obvious coup.
Again, the numbers are very conflicting. How many people were on the street on the 30th of June? How many people are still supporting Tamarod after the military intervention? How many people are still supporting them after the assaults on the sit-ins? I can't tell you any of these numbers. I think all of this will be just, you know, a guessing game. My only cue as to how many people in Egypt support the Brotherhood and how many are opposed to them goes back to the numbers that we have from the elections of 2012. You know, in the first round of elections, President Morsi garnered some 5 million votes. Those are the supporters, the true supporters of the Brotherhood. In the second round of the elections, where it was, a competition between him and the military person, Ahmed Shafiq, he got 13 million. It was a very close, if you remember, it was a very close you know, competition between him and Ahmed Shafiq. Of those 30 million, there are 8 million people who voted for him in order to avoid a military person becoming Egypt's new president. And I feel that all these 8 million have been disappointed by his policies during his year as president. So add to the 8 million, the 12 million who already in 2012 were supporting the military and Ahmed Shafiq, and you get some 20 million Egyptians who are, you know, actively opposing President Morsi, and 5 million who are actively supporting him. For those who didn't vote, I can't count them, and I seriously doubt that anybody can claim that they can fairly and accurately count them.
Well, but we can count the fact that I think 22 million people did sign a petition asking for Morsi to step down. That was,
if you believe that number, then yes.
Right. Well, I think your caveat is well taken, Noah Radwan. But again, the only voice that seems to be reasonable.
I mean, this number that you cite, 22 million, comes very close to the number that I'm going for,
yes,
which is 8 million besides the original 12 million.
Yeah. No.
So that number sounds right. I just can't, you know, confirm that this is the number.
Right.
But it sounds about right to me.
Well, but at this point, the, you know, the, who is going to support a military coup, the killing of their own citizens? It seems to that the fact that this was an incredibly unpopular government run by apparently a rather boneheaded and not particularly bright leader who was very much a compromise candidate. And as you pointed out, a lot of people voted for him simply because they didn't want a relic from the old Mubarak era. That was their only choice.
He certainly proved incompetent, and he also proved to be too inflexible and did not respond to any of the calls of those who were not part of the Brotherhood. I know that there were numerous efforts from outside the Brotherhood to, advise President Morsi on how to bring the nation back to a unity, how to avoid the divide that resulted in June 30th protests. Numerous efforts by all sorts of political figures in Egypt, and he, you know, snubbed all of those. He was absolutely confident that he had courted the military and the police enough to protect himself from the people. I think that was a horrendous mistake on his part.
So at this point, the liberals seem to be sort of underground. We have martial law, which is going to go on for a whole month. And I guess the questions are whether or not there is any, the only voice of reason that we know about was the who was the vice president, Mohamed al-Baradei, the Nobel laureate. And he said, just quoting him, "We have reached a state of harder polarization and more dangerous division, with the social fabric in danger of tearing, because violence only begets violence. The beneficiaries of what happened today are the preachers of violence and terrorism, the most extremist groups, and you will remember what I am telling you." I mean, that's pretty gloomy, isn't it?
It is, but I don't think that al-Baradei is the only voice of reason. He's certainly a very reasonable man and has a lot of scruples and good principles. But I hate to think that he's the only voice of reason. So I'm hoping for other voices to emerge and call for restraint on both sides. And we'll just have to wait and see what transpires. At this point, it does not look good, I agree. But one has to always be hopeful that something better would transpire.
And this is really an Egyptian affair. I think here in the United States, the assumption always is amongst those both on the left and the right that the U.S. Tells everybody what to do and everybody...
At this point, and I think since a lot earlier than this point, I always felt like the U.S. intervention in the Egyptian affair, since 2011, by the way, has always made things worse rather than better. They either speak too late, speak too softly, speak too harshly, threaten to cut the U.S. aid, which my feeling is that it's more important for American interests in the region than it is for the average Egyptian at this point. So I think at this point, actually, the best response that the U.S. can take is to just stay put.
Well, apparently the anti-Morsi media, the anti-Muslim Brotherhood media, are already portraying al-Baradei as an American puppet. So it's an odd situation where you have people in this country who want the President of the United States to cut off military aid, which in effect most of that military aid actually ends up, you know, here in the United States, where they build tanks and aircraft, and it has very little to do with Egypt. That's happening on the one hand, and then my understanding is that Morsi is, I mean, that Sisi, the general, is extremely angry with the United States, and that's the card that they're playing. And curiously, a lot of Egyptians appear to believe that the U.S. is actually behind putting Morsi in there. So that seems to be. Isn't that kind of confusing?
You know, there's enough animosity among the public towards the United States to where whichever side claims that the United States is helping the other side win. So you see that the secular media is claiming that Obama has been supporting the Brotherhood since their first ascending to power. On the other hand, the Brotherhood claims that the whole coup is, you know, engineered with the support of the United States. Given this situation, the best thing I think that the United States can do is to stay out of the whole affair. It is also my feeling that this is really primarily an Egyptian affair. It's not something for the United States to decide one way or the other.
Well, and I hope from your lips to God's ears, I say. And thank you so much for joining us, Noah Radwan.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Noah Radwan, who's a professor of Arabic and Comparative Literature at the University of California, Davis. She was born in Egypt and was among the participants in the Tahrir protests of 2011. And we are going to now, I'm joined in the studio by the general manager of KPFK, Bernard Duncan, and the rest of the program. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about a big convention in Washington of the Association of Unmanned Vehicle Systems International show, how the drones are descending on Washington. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Alexei Kossoff, who is a multimedia journalist currently reporting for the Los Angeles Times Washington Bureau. His latest article with Brian Bennett in Thursday's Los Angeles Times is Drones Descend on Washington Just for Show. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alexei Kossoff.
Thank you so much for having me.
And this is an extraordinary irony that you have covered this trade fair in Washington. It's a three-day event in the big convention center in Washington, packed with drones, surveillance gear, and other high-tech gizmos for both government and private use. And so let me begin with the question about who are the customers for all this stuff? Who's wandering around? I mean, do they have kind of pretty girls in bikinis trying to sell missiles? Is that what's going on here?
No, it's a little more professional than that. There was a lot of companies there that really seemed to be pitching their products and the potential of drones in the domestic sphere and the way it can be used at home rather than the way we've always seen it and imagined it in the combat zone. So there was talk about how it could be used by police for surveillance or how it could be used for search and rescue efforts by a fire department. How it could be used to monitor traffic, things like that, to just make it seem sort of safer and much more accessible. And then there was there were all sorts of different vendors there. There were states that were trying to attract businesses to come and you know, pitch themselves as good places to test drones. And there were companies there that were exploring the ways that drone technology is now being used on cars and in boats. So all sorts of different things.
So the organizers, though, apparently had keynote speakers and had various panels. Tell me about the keynote speakers and what was the thrust of what they were trying to say?
I think there's sort of several concerns that the drone industry is facing right now. Obviously, from people, there are huge issues with privacy, and they're concerned about what kinds of legal challenges will arise when airspace opens for commercial use of drones in the U.S. in the next couple of years. So, you know, there's discussion about how to approach that and how to handle the sort of legal challenges that will come and how to assuage people's fear about sort of this invasion of privacy. And then also with the sequester happening and budget cuts to the Defense Department, there's concern over, you know, how to make drones a viable technology and how to grow the industry when sort of their biggest customers are facing cutbacks. So that's sort of another interesting issue that they're dealing with right now that was, you know, being discussed.
So if the FAA allows for the domestic use of drones, and you say it will happen within the next couple of years, what are the lines then between the manufacturers' models that they have on display at the Washington Convention Center for this big gathering of the Association of Unmanned Vehicle Systems International's show? What is the line between people that make them themselves and the manufacturers them? I mean, you know, people can make their own home-built aircraft, for example, and fly them around. So I've seen lots of footage of, you know, small drones. So I'm wondering what, you know, what the rules of the road are going to be once drones are unleashed on airways of America.
Right. Well, so drones for private use of, you know, we sort of think about them are allowed right now, but Congress has actually ordered the FAA to open up the airwaves for commercial use of drones within, I believe, the next 2 years. So there's, you know, discussion about how those can be incorporated into all sorts of different, you know, uses with police or search and rescue, farming, agriculture. They're looking for, you know, different ways to incorporate them into all aspects of life.
So, again, I'm speaking with Alexei Kozoff, who's a multimedia journalist currently reporting for the Los Angeles Times' Washington Bureau. His latest article with Brian Bennett in Thursday's Los Angeles Times is Drones Descend on Washington Just for Show. Give us a sense of the surveillance equipment and the booths that are selling the latest in surveillance gear. Obviously, you know, this has been the surveillance summer in terms of news stories following the Edward Snowden revelations, and of course they will continue. And we had that very close vote in the Congress where the NSA barely maintained this secret program that it's doing from a challenge to shut it down. So there's no question that in the public's mind, there's a lot of a growing concern about the extent to which the government is snooping on American citizens. So I find it pretty ironic that they're out selling this stuff. Who are they selling it to, and what are they selling?
I mean, the vibe of it was a little bit strange and even creepy in some ways. You might walk down an aisle and there'd be a screen there and you would suddenly see yourself on it and not know sort of where the image was being transmitted from. But, you know, there's a lot of different kinds of drone aircraft that ranging in size. And so what they're looking for, you know, for there might be tiny little cameras that would fit on small aircraft for, you know, these domestic uses that we talked about. And then there might be these big, high-quality cameras that would attach to, you know, large planes and things for the type of border control or combat missions that have gotten sort of the most attention in terms of drones. So, you know, the technology, they're looking about how to make it, you know, smaller, higher quality, or more stable. A lot of it was focused on this idea of sort of giving this very solid and 360-degree sort of vision for the most high-tech missions.
So what was the division then between the – if the organizers were trying to sell drones – in terms of their domestic potential, you know, to monitor forests for fires and to help police, et cetera, you would think that they'd play down the military angle. But I understand that there were also defense contractors there selling their wares.
Yeah, and there were soldiers walking around in uniforms. It was sort of a funny funny dichotomy, you know, people in their business suits next to people in military uniforms. But definitely there was a sense of downplaying. You know, no one used the word drone. Everything was unmanned. And but obviously you can't get away from that identity completely. So I think there's just a sense of trying to make drones seem more comfortable and less sort of scary in all their power and the things that we've heard about them doing abroad.
And what was the sense that they give of, you know, the resolution of these things and the extent to which still, I imagine, what they call national technical means, which are the CIA's and the National Reconnaissance Office's ability to spy on anything and everything in the world. You know, it's a huge multi-billion-dollar program that's been going on for decades. And of course, what they keep classified is the resolution of how much they can see. But there have been rumors that they can read license plates and stuff like that. I imagine now with the proliferation of drones, the ability of these, and I'm sure that's what they were selling at this convention, the infrared and other abilities, because mm-hmm. one of the big concerns is that the Fourth Amendment is basically completely eviscerated by drones. If they can fly over your home with infrared and watch you inside your home, you know, so much for the Fourth Amendment's idea of keeping you, you know, safe and private in your home and amongst your possessions and papers.
I think that's obviously going to be the biggest challenge that comes up. But among people who have every interest in seeing it grow and sell, I think they just want to focus on the positive. And, you know, a lot of the focus of what was being sold at the convention was, you know, things that seemed sort of highly visible and, you know, less sort of creepy in what they were capable of doing. And so, you know, there were places where, you know, you could see these infrared cameras that they were developing and stuff, but, you know, that they never would really get into those issues of you know, what that actually meant in terms of implications of use. In terms of the industry itself, I'm sure that's an issue that, you know, they're debating and grappling right now, and the best approaches to, you know, the challenges that will inevitably arise over concerns of Fourth Amendment.
But did you see anything that gave you pause that showed the technological ability to basically invade your privacy?
I mean, they're definitely developing infrared cameras with, you know, that they can sense heat and things. So you might see a camera and, you know, you walk away and on the screen, you know, you lift up your foot and it can see sort of where you've left the footprint, things like that, you know. It does give you some pause. It's a little bit strange. So, you know, you have to hope that it will just not be used in terribly nefarious ways, but who knows?
So, Alexei Kosov, what were the panels then that were conducted for, you know, were you able to go to any of them? What, you know, how were they breaking them down? What aspects of the new frontiers of drones and drone sales of drones? What was on display and within these obviously different categories that the panels were about?
Yeah, well, I was mostly going around talking to exhibitors and looking at what they had, but you know, there was a big emphasis on obviously the air potential of drones and what that can mean, and then you know, people looking at the potential in maritime and how that could be used to sort of increase security in sort of Navy operations and other things that happen, you know, with like ocean security and stuff.
So in your article in the Thursday's LA Times, Alexei Kossoff, that you wrote with Brian Bennett, Drones Descend on Washington Just for Show, you describe these huge sort of banners and signs for the big familiar companies like Lockheed Martin and all of the big and well-known defense contractors. But you quote Melanie Hinton, a spokeswoman for the conference, saying this is a growth industry. And as the military wars wind down, people are seeing the value of unmanned systems, air, ground, and maritime, and how they can be used in civil and commercial life. So was that the purpose of this convention? In other words, we got out of Iraq, we're getting out of Afghanistan, we don't want to get into Syria, but there's going to be an absolute bonanza on the domestic front. Is that what the message was?
Yeah, I don't think people who are building drones have no need to create a convention just to reach the military. This is really about opening things up on a domestic level, reaching out to potential customers who would have uses for them in daily life and selling people on the merits of that. A lot of the emphasis is on ideas of efficiency and just taking industries to the next level because of what the potential of drone technology is. So this is really a big show to sell people on the civilian potential of drones.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Alexei Kossoff.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Alexei Kossoff, who is a multimedia journalist currently reporting for the Los Angeles Times' Washington Bureau. His latest article with Brian Bennett in Thursday's Los Angeles Times is Drones Descend on Washington Just for Show. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.